Campus FM presents a talk with Professor İlber Ortaylı, president of the Topkapi Palace Museum in Istanbul. This talk is presented by Mr. George Kassar.
This is George Kassar talking to you from Campus FM. I have with me a distinguished guest, Professor İlber Ortaylı, who is currently president of the Topkapi Palace Museum in Istanbul. Let me just give you a brief CV of Professor Ortaylı. Well, Professor Ortaylı has had an interesting academic career path. He took a double major in Ankara University from the Faculty of Political Science and the Faculty of Arts, History and Geography. He then studied for his master's degree at the University of Chicago and received his doctorate in 1974. He has held several academic posts and has served as visiting professor at many prestigious universities all over the world. Professor Ortaylı was the chair of the Department of History of Public Administration at Ankara University, and from 2002 until 2004, he taught at Galatasaray University in Istanbul, and later at Bilkent University, Department of International Relations in Ankara. Professor Ortaylı is an executive committee member of the International Ottoman Studies Association and holds membership in the European Association of Iranian Studies. He is currently the president of the Topkapi Palace Museum and is, as one might imagine, author of many books and papers on his subject. As a historian, I have a particular interest in the history of Turkey, and therefore I'm delighted to welcome Professor Ortaylı on the program. So, Professor Ortaylı, welcome to Malta, and welcome to Campus FM. Let's go to the first question. Now, the first question is something which you might not be so much equipped to answer, because your stay here has been short. But what is your first impression of Malta?
Beautiful country, beautiful climate. These are first impressions. And what I would like to say, I'm not disappointed, because if one studies a country before his visits, he easily can be disappointed sometimes. That means, I mean, an imaginary exaggeration before his trip. But Malta didn't disappoint me. It's a lovely country. Now I can understand why the Maltese are so much in love with their country.
Good. Now, let's go to something which is more academic. Well, your areas of study include the 16th and 19th century Ottoman Empire. Now, the 16th century interests us Maltese in a special way, as at that time Malta had just been given to the Order of St. John, and the Ottoman Sultan was not at all happy about it. So much so that in 1565, a Turkish expedition was sent to Malta to drive the Knights of St. John out of the island. Did you have occasion to study this particular period with regards to the Ottomans and the Order of St. John? What can you tell us about your findings?
Well, what we have in our knowledge, certainly, in order to have the full sovereignty of Mediterranean Sea, you need two islands. These are Sicily and Malta, especially, two basic strongholds. In that time, Crete was still not Turkish. They conquered, the Turks conquered it in 1662, after a long battle and siege of 30 years.
Yes.
And even Cyprus had been conquered after 1570. So two naval bases in the eastern part and two naval bases on the western part of Mediterranean Sea. And I would say, however, we had Crete and Cyprus after that, Malta was never a Turkish base from time to time. The Turkish corsairs and official naval forces besieged the island. They attacked some strongholds, but that was not, I mean, a permanent stronghold for the Turkish Empire. So it's quite understandable after the conquest of Rhodes, because the Halicarnassus part was already Turkish in 15th century.
Yes.
After the conquest of Rhodes, the order of the St. John had a very, very basic basic loss in its power, and now they had to attack to Maltese dominions that the Turks couldn't. Together with Vienna in 1529, the first siege of Vienna by Suleiman the Magnificent, the other one is, of course, the Malta in 1565. So these two attacks, who had been not well organized, and the season was not able, and the naval forces had not a good coordination between Dragut and Piale Pasha, Malta could not fall into the hands of the Turks. On that, I mean, they lost certainly, I mean, the dominion and the control of the Western Mediterranean. And so that Malta became the stronghold of Western Christianity, and with, well, maybe not exaggeration, quite right, stronghold of Western culture, they say. However, Malta is a Semitic island and an Eastern country. After 16th century, it became slowly, a stronghold of Western culture too, with its music, architecture, with education, philosophy, etc. And all this helped to Italianization of the Malta, which is very important for its history and for its cultural identity, to stop the influence of Britain, to stop the influence of France, etc. And so Malta could survive as the descendants of the Phoenician Semitic cultures and a part of Italian influence, which is a good event. Certainly the Maltese, a people of 300,000 today on the
today
world.
It's 400,000.
400,000 with foreigners, maybe, huh?
It's 405,000 to be exact.
Wonderful. So we have 400,000 Phoenicians, I mean, on this world. And today it's very important for this small country, for this small island, to have its literary and cultural identity. They have it. And the basic element, and basic element of interpretation of history is that the siege of the Turks and how Maltese defeated it. They have to keep it. No other choice.
Yes.
For Turks, Malta is, I mean, an event. They even don't know it, what happened. Vienna is, of course, much more stressed. But anyway, that would be a common fact in our history, Malta and Turkey, two countries, ideologically they have an enmity, and I think Maltese have to keep it because they have no other choice. They should make their interpretations, historiographical interpretations, which the Turks don't like, and sometimes they find it exaggerated. But we have to understand it.
Yes, yes, yes.
On the other hand, I mean, of course, it's the characters, the Maltese and Turks, Mediterranean peoples, because of developing tourism, they visit each other's country. The Malta Air has every day, I mean, flights.
Yes.
And the Turks like to go there, to come there. And I think they find themselves, each other, very warm and very hospitable. That's the hospitality is most important thing. And they have certainly, I mean, a common future. Coming to the point of scholarly relations, I don't think the Turks paid well attention to the history and language of Malta, which we had to do. Within Semitical studies, we need, I mean, a Phoenician department, a Maltese department. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No one has any idea about Ernst Renan in Turkey. Mm-hmm. The only thing we know him, he had an essay, you know, that Islam prevents the development of the education, and therefore he had been attacked. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But no one has any idea about his service in Semitical philology, etc. We have to know it. The history of Malta, the language, the common history of Turks and Maltese are important. That we should rehabilitate, not at all maybe, construct in our universities, change students. However, we have here Turkish students. I yes, think they study yes. some other branches and yes, not yes. history. Yes. I don't know how many are here, but they are here, I mean. It's a good one. I mean, we don't have any Maltese students, as far as I know.
I don't think there are at the moment. But
No. For example, my university is a university with French instruction.
Yes, yes.
We should have them there, I think. Uh-huh. And some universities are with English instruction, mm-hmm, for mm-hmm. example. They should come there. And these are good universities in Turkey. Well, that's the contemporary situation of Malta and Turkey.
Okay. Now, I'm going to skip on to something else, which is, again, one of your fortes, one of your good themes, which appears a lot in the list of publications that you have. In fact, this concerns the Turkish public administration. In a few words, how would you describe Turkish public administration from a historical point of view, from a historical perspective? Would you consider this system any different from other public administrations of the time, that is, along the historical period that you have
studied? Well, imperial structures are everywhere the same, but I mean the European German type of feudalism is not to be met in Turkish history, of course. Even in modern times, we tended to adopt, I mean, French centralism, because Turkey was a centralistic empire. The main element in Turkish history is the only noble dynasty is the Ottoman house self. We had no nobility, no aristocracy. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Our rulers were recruited peasant children, well-educated, yes. well-trained in palace school. And even our faculty, I mean, political sciences has less to do with political science in Ankara. That was a descendant of the palace, imperial palace mm-hmm, school. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I have studied there, our general directors, our ministers, even so many of the ambassadors, for example, the one in Rome, mm-hmm. who is also accredited to sure. Valletta. The Turkish ambassador. This is a school. This school was very important public administration school to some extent, starting in 15th century. And it produced people. Even harem was a part mm-hmm. of it. Mm-hmm. These girls had been trained there, I mean, to become the wives of this class, I mean, these recruits. So Ottomans have created a new class. An achieving aristocracy, not a well aristocracy. And if your children were not able to keep this post and ability, they easily lost their situation, their conditions and positions in the yes. society. They lost it. This is the difference of Turkish society. And I would say, however, we had not an autonomy, I mean local autonomy, municipality,
yes, yes, yes.
this type of local democracy, these are very new structures in Turkish society. The lack of the nobility, I mean the achieving aristocracy, the lord bureaucracy, the mm-hmm. so-called mm-hmm. one, helped a lot to improve the efficiency of the system in 17th, 16th. Centuries. This is what we have to stress. and say that's the reason, I mean, why the Ottomans had this system.
Just a question about what you are saying. So the top officials, well, all practically educated in the same institution. Now, when it comes to the social structure, the social mobility, being a historical sociologist, it interests me quite a lot, this idea of social mobility. Was there social mobility? How was social mobility along the Ottoman Empire? Was there a chance of people going up or going down the social ladder, not only through the public administration structure, but also through other structures in the state?
Well, I mean, you know, Turkey, till 19th century, was a less developed industrial power.
Yes, yes.
The leading power was Britain, and then France, Austria, Germany, etc. But even France and Austria was far back, I mean, backwarded in comparison to Britain.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Only Germany made his attack, and I mean promotion in industrial areas in 19th century. So Turkish industry, imperial industry, was, I mean, less developed in comparison to others. In such a society, you don't have, I mean, a huge social mobility.
Yes.
Which covers the 20th century, 21st century mm-hmm. of Turkey. So we had, I mean, a parvenu class, therefore, economically,
yes,
but...
Yes.
In bureaucracy, I mean, of course, you don't need any blue blood, as I say.
Yes.
And anyone who had the capacity, who could promote, the able and very well-known Grand Vizier of 19th century, Mehmed Emin Ali Pasha, was the son of a portier in Egyptian bazaar, very
yes.
poor man.
Yes, yes, yes.
And this boy had not an, I mean, formal education. Like many of them, after a short education, they had been trained in sublime port as
mm-hmm.
clerks.
Yes.
He was one of them. He picked up French, etc., and became a very able Grand Vizier of the Empire with a wonderful French and Turkish, of course.
Yes, yes, yes.
His memorandas and reports are, even today, I mean, very admirable things.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say the education of Turkey is quite, quite populous because it's based on a scholarship system.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All the schools are based on scholarship system, not only military schools, even the other civil branches.
Scholarships.
Yeah, you don't need money, you yes. don't need a house, you don't need, I mean, able parents.
Yes, yes, yes.
Just go there, you have your dressing, your food, your education, and even your small pocket money. And so that, I mean, it could produce, for example, the founder of the Republic comes from a very poor family.
Yes.
And I would say very poor. He lost his father, I mean, his mother was mm-hmm. in scarcity
yes.
always. So, but he could be trained because that's the military schools gave him this opportunity, and many I mean, when I was a student, many of my professors came from poor families. I mean, because of the scholarship system, they could study in Turkey and abroad as well.
So it is in fact a meritocratic system. It
meritocratic,
is based on merit,
yeah,
and it is based on ability and achievement.
Achieving,
yes, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
So it is a society which, in fact, doesn't really look at class
yeah.
or at blue blood, as you said, but it looks more at the ability
and other types
and,
of relations.
Yes, yes, yes.
Today they need another type of relations. I mean, of course, there is a competition.
Mm-hmm.
And in competition, group competition, everyone has its own clientele.
Ah, yes, okay. So, let's move on to another question now. Mm. Now, how do you describe Ottoman Turkey's relations with the European powers in the 19th century?
Very bad.
They were very bad.
Turkey was one of the powers, as you know,
yes,
members
yes,
of
know.
The Concert
yes.
European.
Yes.
So they had capitulatory rights, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
It depends how to use it, of course. Britain was very able. Even he couldn't do everything, whatever they wanted, but they could prevent everything, whatever they did not want. That's very important.
Yes.
France was less, Austro-Hungary was less and less. Russia and Turkey was far behind.
But these
are the concept of the big powers.
Yes.
And I should say, Britain and France supported and helped Turkey to resist against Russia, Crimean
War. Yes, in the Crimean War, that's right.
So 19th century, the able statesmen of Turkey were very much in alliance with Great Britain, and that was good for their own mission and for their own road. And only after Russo-Turkish War, even there, Disraeli was in support of Turkey, Turkish and British relations became hard. Met hard days, very strong times. And France, for example, after centuries of friendly diplomacy, during First World War, they had been on other fronts. However, we had not a serious war with France, because in Gallipoli they had been the ally of the British, and they left the battle after a while. Well, we had our enemies in desert, and then in Balkans for a while with France. And during resistance war, France and Italy supported nationalist Turkey against British. Because it's the struggle after World War First. And if you would ask, I mean, to any kind of Turk from older generations, I met these people, of course. I'm now 60, and when I was young, I always had the veterans of the war and people who had the days of First World War and after post-war time. They all had been very anti-British. Anti-Britannism was, I mean, a stereotype of Turkish society, because we had the war with British.
In fact, the Ottoman Empire, up till the First World War, was very close to the German Empire.
Very close. And that was, of course, very wrong. Because, I mean, maybe people were not anti-German, but the ruling circles were Harriman. Atatürk was Gazi Mustafa Kemal Pasha when he was a young officer. And all his companions and similar people were very anti-German. Very anti-German before the First World War. And because of this First World War, because, I mean, to be ally of Germany is worse than their enemy. That's awful. If you have the Germans as ally in a war, it's worse than, I mean, to have them as enemies.
In fact...
And they hated Germans, really.
Yes, it was
a coward hate. And that pushed them, I mean, to a very neutral policy during Second World War. What I can give, Germany wanted to return the Aegean islands, Mytilene, etc., back to Turkey, for example. They didn't accept it because that was a certain alliance. That means a certain alliance with Germany. They didn't want it. And was right, of course. And that's a typical example, for example. On the other hand, certainly, the Turks always recognized the quality, military quality of Germans. That's why they didn't take part, active part on the side of the Allies, Britain and France. So it's a long struggle between Churchill and Inner.
I wanted to ask you, I mean, this influence, this German influence, there was anti-German feeling in certain areas and certain sectors, but was there any real influence?
No, there wasn't. It was a big government with government,
and that's it.
The German advisors had to speak French in Ottoman Empire. Do you know what is the real German influence in Turkey?
Yes, what?
The people who had been kicked out by Hitler, socialists, Jews, and so on.
Yes.
And who took their asylum in Turkey, the refugees, and employed by Atatürk as professors during those days, a large group. They have an influence.
Yes.
That's why then we had good archaeology after that. we could manage our legal reforms. We had it, the Romanization of the Turkish law, and so on.
Yes, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, that's the German influence, and that is very interesting. Not an official
one. Of course, of course.
These are many of them, I mean, they proclaimed it's their Germanship, changed their citizenship, and never back, never have been back to Germany.
Yes, to Germany.
Some of them never spoke any word in German.
It's interesting. I didn't know that. It's quite an interesting idea that it was in fact the academics that influenced the Turkish people, but not the government.
A generation had academic influence. They spoke German.
Yes.
They loved Germans, etc. That was a generation, not my generation.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, okay.
But that's the last, of course, I mean, this EU, European Union policy of Germany, and the Turkish minority in Germany, etc. This have created a kind of antipathy again.
Okay, so let's stop for a break, a short break, where we hear a little bit of, well, music that Professor Oltari probably is a little bit familiar with, because it's Turkish music. So we'll stop for a little bit and we'll come back in just a few seconds.
Çok sevdim, tanıdığım aşkın en saf halini. Kokladım gecelerce, bıraktım eşyayı boş evi. Uzanamadım elin telefona. Defalarca gidip geldi. Yenik düştüm kendimi göre göre. Gurur sandım aslında ümitsizliğimdi. Anladım temelli gittiğini. Haklıydın üstelik. Canımın içi iki gözüm sakın küsme. Bana hediye bırak bütün kederleri. Ben ağlarım ikimizin yerine. Sen üzülme, gönlüm incinme. Canımın içi iki gözüm sakın küsme. Hediye bırak bütün kederleri. Ben ağlarım ikimizin yerine. Yanadır ya yürek, fena ama kendinden yanadır ya yüreğin. Fena edip aşkı korur ya kendini. Yeni düştüm.
Good, welcome back. A reminder to our listeners, welcome to our program on Campus FM. We're going to continue with our interview with Professor İlber Ortaylı, a prominent Turkish academic. This is George Kassar talking, in fact, to our distinguished guest. Now, Professor Ortaylı, I know that you are presently the president of the Topkapi Palace Museum. There is no doubt that this is a very important museum. What can you tell us about it?
Well, Topkapi Museum is the Ottoman residence, starting in 1459-60, in that year after the conquest of Istanbul, which had been kept and kept till the mid of the 1830s. And after that, it had been left as the foyer des ancêtres, I mean, the house of the ancestors. And in between, this palace is, of course, wonderful tiles. It's a very modest one, not comparable to Louvre or Kremlin, or I mean any kind of modern one. Very modest, but very beautiful, a wonderful location, magnificent. And still is surrounded by a small forest, which is very rare in today's Istanbul. And this palace is a wonderful archive, of course, important for the history of Ottoman peoples on this world and other puissance as well, including Malta. I'm sure you have a good part of your history there, I mean, the connection, the correspondence, etc. You have to read it, you have to study it.
Well, in fact, the problem with academics from Malta and the West is the language itself, because, of course, many of the documents are in Turkish, so it is rather difficult for us.
You should build an Ottomanistic, I'm sure.
I think it is an interesting idea. Yes, it is a very interesting idea.
And then, I mean, certainly we have a library of 22,000 manuscripts, Arabic, Persian, Turkish, Armenian, Greek, Latin, Italian, and even Hungarian.
Hungarian, yes.
Because they had been bibliophiles and collected from everywhere. Soliman the Magnificent brought from Hungary his Corvinus library, Matthias Corvinus, a well-known music notebook. It's been restored and emanated and published, for example, Corvignana. So the library is very important. And then 12,000 Chinese pieces, porcelain, including very sui generis, very, very special, peculiar pieces.
Yes, yes, yes.
900 Japanese porcelain, and of course Turkish too. And then the treasury, of course, including many Indian ones, of course, the Baburites, and not only Turkish, and even others. So Topkapi is some place to visit, and some place to aspire. Come and breathe yourself.
Yes, yes, yes, yes. In fact, you're mentioning exhibits from China and Japan and India. How did they come?
No, the Chinese porcelain is largely used by Turks. Largely used.
That's why. Okay.
We used it. 12,000 is used there.
Okay. Then. That's why. I mean,
wonderful.
It was there
Ming
because
porcelain,
it was
celadons,
yes,
lovely, lovely, rare pieces. Not even in China to see them. And many had been produced for the ghosts, for the good, for the taste of the church.
Yes, yes, I know. That's why I understand.
Please.
So they were practically part of usage in Turkey, and they remained, of course, in the Topkapi Museum.
These rare examples.
In fact, we're speaking of the Topkapi Museum and its exhibits. Are there any exhibits that are connected somehow to Malta or to the Maltese?
No, we would like to do it. I mean, Maltese and the Turks. We would like to make an exhibition. It depends, I mean, how can we come together and create it with colleagues, for example. As you see, I mean, for example, yesterday I have visited the heritage of Malta, Dr. Luciano Mulistania.
Yes, yes.
And we have to come together and create an exhibition.
That would be quite an interesting idea. In Malta, I am aware only of a small section in the Palace Armory. I don't know if you have had the time to see it, but there is only a small section of about Turkish armor in our armor museum.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Again, it's only a very, very small section.
Yeah, sure.
Now, speaking about Heritage Malta and museums. Now, first of all, what impressions have you obtained of Maltese heritage sites from the little that you have visited them? And again, speaking about Heritage Malta, have you somehow discussed with Dr. Molestania or other officers about this collaboration, which you seem to be really thinking
first
about?
First, they even should come to us. I mean,
yes,
they
yes.
haven't been in Topkapi. They should come.
Yes. And what about your impression of Maltese historical sites?
Oh, Maltese historical sites, sir, I mean, well known. This is a country of 2,000 years, at least, I mean. You have a good Phoenician heritage, Neolithic one, but Phoenician heritage. Then, of course, the medieval history of Orient and Occident. It's very important, I mean, the geography and architecture. And even, I mean, it's a part of British history, of course, Malta.
Yes, of course. In fact, we have spent 164 years as a British colony, so...
It was already 400? No, I think it's only after Napoleon.
Yes, it was 200. From 1800 to 1964, when we obtained
Around 2 centuries.
Around two centuries, yes, right. In fact, our...
Not even that, I mean...
It's 164 years, really. Our heritage is something which goes back, as you said, from the Neolithic age, which is going back 5,000 years and more.
Byzantine history is here, Islamic Arab history
is
here.
Yes, we have had...
It's the Arabic part of Islamic world.
Yes, the Arabic part is
because, right. I mean, if you speak of Islamic history, a large part of it belongs to Persian culture.
Yes, yes. Sir.
And then Turkish culture, of course. The Turks are the conquerors, etc. Many of the Islamic states are Turkish. The Turks used it after 11th century, especially. Even Baghdad was conquered by them. And in between Persian history, Persian culture, etc., Indian mathematics. But this part, I mean, this Western Mediterranean, Maghreb, Andalusia, Malta, etc., are totally Arabic.
Arabic, that's right.
So it's a part of Arabic history, Arab history,
Arab
Muslim
history.
Arab history. And so a kind of meeting of old Semitism, Phoenicians again with Arabs. But you could stand again. I mean, some people talk about Arabic language in Malta.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Of course, you borrowed a lot of Arabic words, but it's your language.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's a great task because many of these old Semitic peoples, like Syrians, Arameans, Phoenicians in Lebanon, Copts, etc., they lost their language. Became Arabized, very close language. Mm-hmm. How Malta could stand it, it's very important.
Yes,
very important. This procedure is very important. They kept their old Semitic language.
We are quite proud of that, you know, that we have our own language.
And of course, French and English influence, especially during the reign of Maltese order. They used Latin sometimes, but basically Italian, etc. How did you keep it again? And then Italian helped you to resist British culture.
Yes.
Because British influence, English culture ruined even India, this old civilization. Many of the languages became unuseful. I mean, they destroyed the heritage of it. But here you kept yours, I think, by the influence of Italians.
Italian culture is original. That is true, because our Italian culture somehow was our defense against the British language.
Europe.
Somehow we kept our Maltese vernacular, at the same time Italian. Was the shield against...
The sociologists, historical sociologists would like Malta very much.
Yes, it is. It's quite an interesting island and quite an interesting people, even though we are simply, as I said, very, very small and at the same time, but at the same time quite pronounced in the sense that we have our own language and we are quite important in that sense. Now, let's go on to something else. Now, what comparisons, if any, can you make about present-day Malta and Turkey?
Well, that I talked about it. I mean, we need an embassy like others. Mm-hmm. I met American embassy, of course, British embassy, Greek embassy even, Italian, of course. So we need an embassy here in Malta. Not only consul and honorem.
Yes.
Because we have here now some business people, Turks, who settle down and make their business. And we have visitors. And Malta is a member of European community. However, they keep their money. And on that way, I mean, the accredite ambassador in Rome wouldn't sufficient enough. We need a small embassy here.
That will probably help a lot with regards to relations.
New government should take care of that.
Now, again, another comparison. What about the people themselves? No, it's not diplomacy, politics. The people, the normal
less
people.
Less idea about Maltese history. Many think, I mean, Malta was for a while Turkish province, which is not, of course, attacked by Turks many times. And they had the xenophobia, the Maltese against Turks. That's their national identity, a part of it. Understandable. But we hadn't been here. That's very important. But we like it, I mean, the atmosphere, the climate. Everything, I mean, people like to be here. And I think the Maltese, so are the Maltese. Many people have been in Turkey.
Yes, many Maltese go to Turkey as tourists.
But Malta is also very good prizes. So we have to come together and closer. That would be much better, I think.
That's good. Now, let's go, just a couple of questions and we're finished. Now, in your opinion, what are the prospects for stronger and more beneficial contacts between the two countries? Not simply the embassy itself, but other aspects. I mean, how do you see the relationship? How can they become stronger? I mean, at the
tourism,
moment they are...
I mean, tourism, pocket tours. I mean, joint venture, joint advertisement, joint organization. Malta and Turkey, for example. And then, I mean, of course, academic cooperation, academic cooperation in hydrography, etc., in Mediterranean ecology. It's very important. And, of course, history, first of all. I mean, the whole history of Mediterranean. This is a small country, but it's a really large history, very large. Big volume.
It is.
So you have to study all of the Middle East. I mean, how can you do that? I don't know. For that, you are not enough. Very small.
It's
even,
very small.
I mean.
It's true.
You need, I mean, some partners.
Yes. In fact, that is why I asked you. How do you view these relationships? In fact, again, we're at the University of Malta, and I know that you have. As I have introduced you to our listeners, you are an academic. Do you see any relationships between Turkish universities and the University of Malta?
At the moment, not very, very.
Can you suggest ways how universities can?
Of course, we have to come together. First of all, exchange program, because Turkish students in Malta are very voluntarily. I mean, it's not an organization. They just came here.
Yes.
I don't know how.
Yes.
It's not, I mean, after a well-planned itinerary, mm-hmm. academic mm-hmm. itinerary. So we should create these scholarship programs, etc., and study programs, levels, how to exchange them, exchange of the scholars. We need to come together. I don't think we did it, but we have to.
I don't think at the moment we have done it, as you said, but it is interesting, this exchange between the University of Malta and, of course, the prestigious universities in Turkey. Well, just one question, or rather, just a concluding remark from your side. I mean, can you give us a final message? I mean, anything which you would like to add?
So I would say, come to my museum, come to Turkey, and please see this country. Please meet the Turks and visit it. It's as interesting, more interesting than Lebanon, as you should do it, for example. These are countries you have to know.
Yes, okay then. So, Professor Ortali, it has been a pleasure talking to you. On behalf of the University of Malta and our listeners, I thank you for accepting our invitation. I hope that your relationship with Malta will be a long-lasting and fruitful one. Thank you.
I am very much honored. Thank you.
Sensiz geceleri koynumda uyku girmez gözlerime, bu karanlıklar beni eritse de vazgeçmem senden, aşkı alevinden bilirim günler yeniden doğacak. Ellerin dokununca yüreğin yanacak, bilirim her şey yeniden yaşanacak. Sarılınca boynuna gözlerin doğacak. Yürürüm gecenin üstüne, salarım güneşlerimi, görürüm tane tane açılan güllerimi. Yürürüm gecenin üstüne, günahlardan geçerim, ezerim birer birer yalan sevişleri. Dön bebeğim, dön çaresiz başım, ayrılık böyle uzun sürmez ki. Dön, dön bebeğim, acılar seni. Ayrılık böyle uzun sürmez ki, dön. hasrete gebeyim, dön dön bebeğim, dön çaresiz başım. Ayrılık böyle uzun sürmez ki, dön dön bebeğim, acılar senin, dön dön bebeğim, hasrete.
Just listen to a talk with Professor İlber Ortaylı, president of the Topkapi Palace Museum in Istanbul. This talk was presented by Mr. George Kassar.